You have tuned in to Open Mic on CJSF Radio, broadcasting on 90.1 FM from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
So, you're listening to CJSF 9.1 FM, and we're broadcasting from the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish people, including the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, Kwikutlun, and Qatsi First Nations. These lands have never been surrendered, so they're given up, and we're so grateful to be sharing stories, music, and conversations from this space. And you have tuned in to this open mic, so thank you so much! I'm here broadcasting from Burnaby Campus, my name is Iago, and it's always a pleasure to be back with you on Thursdays. And today, we're gonna be just discussing a few topics on also environment, but on post-secondary education for students in BC and across the country. As everyone knows, there have been a lot of federal caps on international students' visa, rising tuition and budget squeezes all in the mix. And there are a lot of questions from students, but also for these elections, around the future of accessible and sustainable education. And to kick things off, I have first, actually, someone who accepted our open invitation to connect with students and community through this platform. One of the candidates running in Burnaby New Westminster, Tara Sostarian, and she's here to share the space and to talk about youth leadership, environmental challenges, and all of her platform for these elections. Besides that, I also have Joel, current VP External from the student Simon Fraser Student Society, who is going to be talking with me about his work at the Spring Advocacy in Victoria, and a few more of the things that he has been discussing with SFAU and other universities regarding the student international students cap, much more. So let's get into it. Tara, welcome to CJSF.
Hi everyone, thank you for tuning in into CJSF 9.1 FM again. My name is Iago, and today we're speaking with Tara Sostarian from the Green Party, a candidate for New Westminster Burnaby riding. Tara is a long-time advocate for environmental sustainability and social justice, with a background in grassroots organizing that stretches from India's Spico movement to her work here in Burnaby and New Westminster. She served on the City of Burnaby's Environmental Committee, worked with the Force of Nature and the BC Poverty Reduction Coalition, and continues to fight for a just transition, indigenous rights, and affordable housing. I need to say, every candidate was invited from the riding of New Westminster and Burnaby, but I only had the opportunity to speak with Tara. So this is going to reflect her platform and also our interest in covering all the issues that she's been talking in during her riding. But this is not the personal opinion from anyone here at CJSF. So welcome, Tara. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Iago. It's always a delight to be able to communicate with young people and, you know, have innovative, good ideas, I think creative ideas. I just want to mention that I'm coming to you from the unceded traditional territories of the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh nations, the Hakamilam and the Squamish-speaking peoples, and Kwikwetlem nation, I should not forget. And that's because I live, you know, on Burnaby Mountain near the Watch House. And so it's with a sense of duty that I do this acknowledgement. So thank you for having me.
Thank you, Tara. Thank you for the acknowledgement as well. So today our interest is just to cover all her personal and personal interests in writing, her motivations, the issues she's most engaged with, doing a little bit of a political distinction between hers and other parties' platforms, and a broader vision of representation here in this writing. So I know that you've lived here in this region for over two decades, and you have roots in grassroots movements, a lot of organizing, going back to your time in India as well. And so can you tell me what personally drives you to run for office right now?
That's a really good question, Iago. And this is, you know, my third time running. So 2 years ago, I ran as a councillor candidate. Then last year it was as a provincial candidate, and this year, of course, as a federal candidate. And I feel that there are so many systems. We are a great country. Canada is a great country. But there are so many systems that are broken, you know, as regards housing, employability, transportation, indigenous rights, and the list goes on. And affordability, you know, living expenses for people. And that's what really drives me, motivates me to. And above all, climate action.
Yeah. And is there any reason behind this interest of yours? I mean, a lot of people are concerned with these issues, but not as everyone is willing to take a step forward and actually put yourself out there to represent people. So is there a backstory to how you started doing climate activism, doing political representation?
Yes, there is. Because, as I said, I ran for three different levels of government. So the municipal, provincial, and now federal. And the thing is, what we find is... Governments spend a lot on capital costs, which become legacy projects. However, they don't satisfy the needs of the people. So even if you're building, let's say, a great community center, it should be affordable and welcoming for everyone in that society or in that community. And we find that a lot of marginalized people, low-income people, middle-income people are being left out because, for affordability reasons. And also, when we make these projects, there are lots of forest clearing. And so you're not even taking the environment into consideration, and with that there's a lot of soil erosion. We suffer a lot of complications from not taking care of the environment. You know, there are drainage, flooding problems, and air pollution problems, but also we live in an urban forest and we have to be careful about preserving that urban forest and biodiversity. Otherwise, we are going to have, drought-ridden complications in the surrounding area that we're in. So I'm feeling all those impacts, cedars dying, hemlocks dying, and nothing's being done. We are not replanting trees at a fast enough rate. In fact, the city of Burnaby is not going to achieve its 40% canopy rate till 2070. And they are supposed to, reach that target by 2040. And they're falling far behind. So it's all these issues, transportation, how TransLink is holding us to ransom, saying that if the, federal government or the provincial government doesn't put X amount of dollars, then we're going to cut services. So it's all these issues plus housing. I have two children who are adult children. They're living with me because it's just too expensive for them to by themselves, be able to rent. And unless, they can partner up with someone to do the renting. So it's all these things. And young families also coming back to me and, saying that, there's not enough schools, or if they are schools, they're portables. Their kids are in these portable structures, which are not classrooms. And so there's so many issues that really drive me to, take action.
Make you want to step forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Coming from this place of marginalization and your own experience as well, how would you say that your lived experience as an immigrant woman shaped your approach to leadership and policy advocacy here in Canada? How does it affect you directly?
Yeah, I think, so I'll tell you a story. When I came here to Canada, I said, okay, I'm going to just do some, building up degree and then get into work, What happened was we arrived here 23 years ago, and then was the first cut of 50,000 trees on the right of way, taken away from the conservation area on Burnaby Mountain. And so I started, protesting with other people, but I found that, whenever I would go up to TMX or anybody, the first thing they would notice is my accent. Not what I had to say. Oh, okay. Yeah, we know because your accent is like that, so it was, you always felt somehow, that microaggression and felt a little lesser and not having your voice heard. And then, you know, just going, I did a program with the Edmonds Resilience Climate Initiative Resiliency Effort. And that's where I was sort of exposed to not just people like myself, but people from other marginalized communities. In Edmonds, in Burnaby, we're the most diverse in Canada. That quadrant area is the most diverse area in Canada, most marginalized and most socioeconomically backward. And that's what just propelled me. I just said, you know what, I have to do something, not just for climate, but for the upliftment of everyone. Yeah.
Okay. And going for a little bit just on everything that you were mentioning on local issues, don't want to overextend here, but I would love to hear what you're hearing directly from people that you were talking here in the district of Burnaby, New Westminster. What are the things that you're hearing the most from population, from students?
Yeah.
And yeah.
So a lot of it, no surprise, is housing affordability. You know, what are we going to do? There's not enough supply. So housing affordability, you know, so building, what the Greens have decided, we'll go back into building, you know, more co-ops. In the 1970s, that's all that the government did was social housing and co-ops, lots of that. So make sure that that comes into the market. The other thing, what people are saying is with housing is rents. And vacancy control, you know. So right now, landlords can just exponentially raise the rates because there's not being enough control into 2-3% for inflation. So that was one of the things. What was very interesting, and I've heard it from some of the students here and from Douglas College where I went, is transportation also. So right now you have the U-Pass, and they're really happy with it, and, you know, because of the bus connections, they can take that. But what they would like to see is after, when they have precarious jobs, you know, are you going to have a bus pass that is subsidized? I mean, it's being done in Seattle, it's being done in Portland, in the U.S., we can surely do it here. So that was one of the things. And of course, you know, a lot of the students having to access food banks and, you know, refrigeration centers that they have in the universities so that, you know, students don't feel, you know, demoralized or sort of because, you know, they don't want people to see their poverty struggles. It's not poverty. It's we all are dealing with it. But it doesn't. They don't want to be put in that situation where they're seen as the victims. So that was one thing from the students and tuition fees. Tuition fees, they are, they really need help either on student loans or for tuition fees to be much lower. In the OECD countries, they do not have tuition fees, you know, for post-secondary education. And that's what I would like to work towards, but that's the other thing I've been hearing. Transportation, cost of living, housing affordability, and employment. You know, a lot of, this is one of, so I had taken a snapshot of what students had put up on the sticky board. And one thing was that we need apprenticeship or we need, you know, a kind of a body that will help us find jobs, you know, because right now we're not having well-paid jobs. There was a guy who was telling me, a young student saying, oh, you know, I'm going to graduate from my computer science degree and all I can get is data entry. And it's very demoralizing for a lot of students. So that's, you know, that's something that I've heard. Housing affordability is that already. So, yeah, these were the main things.
Just trying to connect a little bit with what you were saying, specifically to employment, mm-hmm. which was your last topic. Mm-hmm. Some candidates speak a lot about transitioning to green jobs, mm-hmm. but your platform emphasizes a just transition. Can you explain what that means and how it plays out locally?
Okay. So what we would do, a just transition means that we have to accept that we need fossil fuels in certain areas. So right now we can't just, you know, stop driving our cars And, you know, just go straight into renewable energy because the infrastructure is not there. We have to, the same kind of subsidies that we give to oil and gas, we need to give it to renewable energy. And you need it for, you know, things like in hospital equipment and all. So you need things which are plastic. So we're being practical. What, and that's what we mean by a just transition. So for certain essential things which require fossil fuels, the projects that are currently there on the ground, LNG or oil and gas, you keep them. But there has to be a moratorium on future LNG or you know, fossil fuel projects and or coal, other extractive projects. But what you do is you take those subsidies and you start investing in renewable energy, solar energy, wind energy, geothermal, and then slowly transition into, you know, into renewable energy so that no workers are left behind. Right now, you have a lot of workers in the oil and gas sector. What has happened from Alberta, there are certain, you know, they call themselves the iron and earth workers. So they're taking whatever are their competencies and their tools, and they're retooling it so that they can work in the renewable energy sector. You know, for wind energy, wind turbines, solar panel, you know, photovoltaic solar panel, you know, just making sure that they're functioning properly. So this is what we mean by going into a just transition. And also, you know, the raw materials that we have in Canada, we are rich in resources. So developing them, not just, you know, right now, what do the other parties or, you know, just the general thinking is rip and ship. That means just rip it out from the ground and then let's just export it. What we are saying, make them into value-added products, you know, and then find good markets for them. So that's what just transition means.
Okay, so one more question. Just thinking about democracy, there's a lot of talks about the state of democracy, about threats that come from the United States. But thinking about a long-term commitment that the Green Party has done, which is advocation for democratic reforms like proportional representation, seeing that Green Party is being excluded from some major political spaces, such as federal debates, what does this say about the state of democracy in Canada today? And how can we ensure more fair and inclusive political representation?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. Because today I feel Canadians are going back to what they always do, is strategic voting. That is, either you vote for one evil and the lesser evil. And that's what's happening between the Conservatives and the Liberals right now. In my one of my last debates, or it was a candidate meet and greet, I had mentioned about if we are not ready for proportional representation as yet, we should be looking at a coalition government, a strong coalition government. Don't give one party the complete power, because power corrupts. And if you do that, then if there's a coalition, then you hear many other different voices. Now, I'm also, and this is a real passion of mine, because I am one of the directors on Fair Vote Canada, where we do advocate for participatory democracy and electoral reform. And I think electoral reform is the way to go, because you get so much of more representation. Look at a country like Denmark. They have about 15 parties that are in the government. And that representation comes from many smaller groups, some advocating for climate, some advocating for, you know, a better economy. And so you get to hear all the voices and much better outcomes for the rest of the citizens of that country happens, whether it's on housing, whether it's on climate, whether it's on affordability. And what we have previously, you know, proposed to parties is, don't take our word for it. Let's have citizen assemblies all around Canada and let the people decide. We should not take, politicians shouldn't take away that power. It should be with the people to decide what kind of a system they want. They want to change the electoral system, then that they have to decide that. And so that is what we're advocating for, citizens' assembly, which will finally move towards electoral reform.
That explains a lot. Yeah. And I think that a good thing to touch is, of course, coming from the Green Party, how social and climate just must go hand to hand. I don't want to put you in a position of criticizing other candidates. Where do you think that other major parties fall short in their platforms when it comes to connecting social and climate justice?
Yeah, that's really a good question, because they all want to be seen now as moving somewhat towards climate. Not so much climate, but they all are saying, oh, we care for the people. Do they really care for the people? Because right now you're giving all your major contributions to big corporations. You're giving subsidies to the oil and gas industry. If you had siphoned off that money of these subsidies and, you know, put it in for climate mitigation. We have a lot of climate disasters now happening with floods and, you know, fires. And instead of, you know, and what happens is when these disasters happen, then the government says, oh, yes, we have money for housing and for healthcare and for education and for cost of living. But sorry, now, and for transportation, but sorry, now we have to pivot because we need to put money into these disasters. So, and who does these disasters normally affect? It is Indigenous people, it is marginalized people who live in certain areas which are prone to, you know, which, for example, in the Edmonds area, you don't have tree canopy, you know, that much tree canopy. So they're more prone to the heat dome if there's anything, you know, heat related or, you know, any sort of heat wave disaster. So that is the thing, you know. So they are the most people who are marginalized. The other thing is, you know, where do they set up all these plants? One is that they set up these plants in, I don't know if you've heard of Chemical Valley in Sarnia, near Toronto. And that's near, you know, marginalized and Indigenous people. So they suffer the brunt of all the air pollution or soil pollution that's there. Then in Nova Scotia, near the big dump, they have a black community, you know. And they, so this policy of not taking care of the most marginalized or the socioeconomic deprived communities, you know, this is what, you know, is there. But also for anybody who's living, it doesn't have to be marginalized. It's anyone. It can be, you know, even low income white working family that gets affected by all these decisions that are made. So, yeah.
Yes. And talking about all of those plans, all of those issues, there's a lot of coverage and there's a lot of media attention to the polarization that's happening. Parties are playing like you can only have one candidate winning and the others don't matter because you're going to affect the final score. So how do you think that a green federal leadership can better support municipal governments in dealing with issues like you've mentioned, homelessness, housing, transit infrastructure, etc.?
So how can the federal government affect municipal, right?
Yeah, how can an elected green...
green official. I think a lot. And especially if that green elected official is me, because I deal with so many municipal issues, but that's just a joke. I think, you know, what happens is, Iago, is that municipalities have certain targets that they have to complete, where, you know, in infrastructure for the municipality or how they have to deal with climate disasters, etc. they do get certain money from property taxes, but then they have to look towards a lot of funding from the federal government. So the federal government can actually, can form this sort of a coalition with the municipalities, give the money for, let's say, infrastructure like sidewalks, like bicycling paths, like, you know, building and maintaining roads so that, you know, better transportation facilities can happen. Again, money for housing corporations to have, building homes, basically. So the municipal government zones an area for building homes. What the federal government can do is actually build those homes, put the funding into them, and make sure that they are actually social housing or, you know, purpose-built rentals, which are, you know, you only spend 30% of your income on your rental property. So, you know, we can really coordinate and work really well in so many different areas. And, you know, the other thing would be also, you know, our storm management, drain management, all these things for a growing, like in Burnaby and New Westminster, we're becoming highly densified. And so there in civil structures like drains, like sewage systems, there's tremendous pressure on them. The city itself does not have the money to build these infrastructures, and that's where the federal government comes in.
Okay, finally, yeah. With all of this, if yeah. elected, what's one project or policy you would want it to be remembered for that you wanted to champ during your term? You have something that comes to mind?
Yeah, I would. One would be, you know, if we could, speaking in the terms of just transition, first of all, we have to make sure, you know, housing is a human right. And that is one thing I would like to do, is see that there's enough housing, but enough housing which is comfortable, you know. So either we retrofit these homes so that they can then have, you know, kind of an energy security, which is put electric heat pumps in them where they don't have to pay for this escalating energy costs. Because, you know, after housing and transportation, it's actually our energy and food bills that are costing us the most. And that is something I'd like to be remembered for. And because because I live on Burnaby Mountain, you know, the preservation of this conservation area is really important to me. So working, that's the first year. Then we'll talk about the second year. Yeah.
Okay. That was all my questions for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Sarah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Iago.
Hi, I'm Kaylin.
And I'm Rebecca.
We're the hosts of Sociologic, broadcasting live at CJSF 90.1 FM from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday.
Tune in to hear meaningful conversations exploring all ideas through a sociological lens.
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in to this open mic and for following my interview with Tara. Next, I'm going to be interviewing Joe Gelani about international students visa cap and about post-secondary education funding model. So thank you for being here with me and follow up for this next interview.
So just for more of an introduction, if that's okay for you, starting from the top, how do you see that international students cap are shaping the broader conversation around university funding right now?
It's difficult. People are actually excited about diversity in the classroom because of the student caps going away. The conversation has turned into such that we're having a broader diversity of students coming in. Universities, at least at SFU, they've had to shift their international strategy. So they're going to more countries and they're not relying on these major feeder countries of sorts like India and China. So we're having a more diverse classroom environment. So that's been good. What's probably a point of struggle is we got to this point because of successive governments sort of forcing our public institutions